KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Mid-Missouri source for in-depth news, diverse talk, music of the world. My name is Mike Hagan, and this is Radio Orbit. Tonight we've got Stephen Herod Buhner and the music of Yachai. Back in just a few minutes, we'll get it going right now. All right, hi, everybody. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. That was Hibiscus, and the band is called Yachai. You may have heard them before on the program. You'll hear more of them throughout the show tonight as we get going with things here, okay? All right, it is Monday night, as always, 11 p.m. till 2 a.m., sometimes a little afterwards these days because we got no one following up the show after I finish up at 2. That's sort of a clarion call for someone out there who wants to do interesting radio in the middle of the night. There's a couple, 3 hours after my show that's open. So, you know, if you're interested, come on down to the station and talk to Jules or David or me or someone, and we'll find out if you got what it takes. All right. Anyway, it doesn't take much. So, anyway, let's see. Like I say, the 8th of January, 2007. Tonight, Stephen Herod Buhner. And the music of Yachai. All right. Before we get into that, thanks to Debbie Johnson. As always, Free Range Radio Theater, wonderful stuff. Finishing things off tonight with the apocalypse of Willie the Lizard or Lenny the Lizard or Bill Lizard, I think it was actually. Anyway, always great stuff on Free Range Radio Theater, 10 p.m. until 11 p.m. Before the show gets on the air, just an hour beforehand. All right. Before Debbie, of course, we have Kelvin and Jason. Doing it up, jazz plus blues equals who can tell. Tech Radio, informative as always, helping us out with our technological wizardry. Jeff Wheeler starting things off always on Mondays from 3 to 5 p.m. Every Monday, Radio Extraordinaire here on KOPN. Great to be a part of it. And we'll keep it up tonight, hopefully. All right? All right, thanks to everybody who listened and participated last week. Thanks for making it a memorable show for the wonderful Rick Levine. Awesome stuff. Rick is really amazing. He's obviously an astrologer and one who sort of makes a living doing that on the one hand, but he's also a rationalist and a scientific genius, as a matter of fact, on the other. He knows a whole lot about a whole lot of stuff, and it's great to have him on the program for the new year. So happy new year to you. Here we go. All right. If you missed it, the program's on the web, www.mikehagan.com, H-A-G-A-N, and just click on over to the program archives, and you can download that and listen to it, share it with your friends, whatever, all right? Okay, like I said, tonight we have a remarkable interview I did recently with Stephen Herod Buhner. For those of you familiar with the program and longer-time listeners, Stephen's been on the show a number of times before, once with our friend Dennis McKenna, as a matter of fact. That was a wonderful show that we did maybe last April, I guess it was, with Dennis and Stephen. But at any rate, he's a brilliant author, wrote so many great books, among them The Lost Language of Plants, Sacred Plant Medicine, The Secret Teachings of Plants. He writes about Lyme disease, about intelligence in nature. He also writes about things like beer. Anyway, tonight we are going to talk about one of our favorite things, the plant people, people of the green, the earth, the wood. And we'll also mix it up with the music of Yachai. All right? Speaking of plants, yeah, we started things off with a song called Hibiscus. We'll have more from Jeff and William along the way tonight. They've got a brand new project. It's called The Insect Sessions. And I'll be featuring some music from that particular bunch of music. And I'll also have a few songs, couple at least, from a project of Jeff's that's called Sorcerer. Anyway, you can check them out if you'd like on the web at Yachai Music, YachaiMusic.com, YachaiMusic.com. And I also like to say thanks to Dennis Thielman, Soul Valor. The music for the program last week was wonderful. So you can find him on the web as well at myspace.com/soulvalor, S-O-U-L. V-A-L-O-R, all right? Great music, and we'll have more of it tonight, okay? All right, hello to everybody out there listening over the web, live or otherwise. We are doing it every Monday night, 11 until 2, on the traditional airwaves, KOPN, 89.5 FM. You can find information about KOPN, of course, on the web at kopn.org. And we also stream the program on Monday nights, thanks to the wonderful people over there at www.cosmicwavesradio.com. So, yeah, thanks to both of those wonderful organizations for making it possible for me to do the show on Monday night and get it out there to everybody who'd like to hear it. All right? Also, while we're thanking people, Larry, the web wizard, as always, great stuff and always something for you new on the web. Although Larry's sort of down and out right now. He had a computer disaster a couple of days ago. I don't know what's going on. Out there on the West Coast, there was a bunch of people that had problems with their computers over the last couple of weeks. And Kent, as a matter of fact, Kent Stedman from CyberspaceOrbit.com, he attributes at least part of his trouble to the solar activity that's been so wild over the last 30 days or so. So I don't know. Maybe that happened to Larry. Maybe not. We've had hacker troubles and all kinds of stuff, as you always, you know, can imagine. But at any rate, he'll be back, and he's always got something for you on the website. It's only his personal system that's down. The website's still up, right? The forum's still up. Knock on wood. All right. Leave us alone, you people. Unless you want to be nice, all right? We're more than happy to talk. We just want to play nice, all right? Okay, anyway, thanks to Larry for putting everything together on the web. We've got wonderful music that's been coming in. I got a great CD in the mail today, as a matter of fact. Well, I just sort of found it tonight when I came in to the station. And I don't even have it sitting here, but it's a girl, a local girl. And anyway, she's sounds really good from a couple of little things that I heard. So we'll hopefully welcome her on the program here in the next few weeks or in the next month or two, whatever. But anyway, great stuff from all over the place coming in, and not just music, you know, art and poetry. We've got places now for all this stuff up on the forum, and I'm going to start a photography section as well, I think. That's a hint to Larry out there. But anyway, you'll have a place to post some of your photographs, you know. Anyway, all this stuff, we love it. Send more. And once again, hats off to Larry for pulling it all together and making it happen on the web. Check it out. Let me know what you think of it, okay? Go over to Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. You'll have access to everything we're doing. And I'd love it if you'd take a look and see and let me know what you think, all right? We also have a forum, as I mentioned, and a live chat that's up and active right now. The forum is a wonderful place to check out every once in a while during the week. There's always interesting things being discussed over there, and it's a great place for sort of breaking news as well. But anyway, tonight, live, the chat room up and active, and I say hello to everyone over there. All right, we'll peek in there every once in a while for questions and comments, and I encourage everybody every week, listeners, guests, whoever, to join us in the chat room and in the forum, but certainly in the chat during the program. It's real fun to interact with other people while the show's going on. So, anyway, the email address, orbitradio@aol.com. That's orbit, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio@aol.com. And on the web at Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. All right. Let's see. Let's talk a little bit about some shows that are coming up in the future. What time is it? It's about quarter after. We'll do that, and then I'll play a song. And I don't know. I'm not really sure how I'm going to structure the show tonight, because the interview that I have with Stephen is a recorded interview, and it's about an hour and 10 minutes long, and I'll throw one break, I think, in the middle of it there. So I'll probably start the interview at about quarter till, in about a half an hour, as opposed to right at the top of the hour, and then it'll finish up about 1 o'clock, and we'll have the last hour of the program to chat and take some questions from the audience and play some more music and do it that way, okay? So that's sort of the idea right now, but we'll have to see how that whole thing pans out. You know how it works here on Orbit, all right? Okay, as we all know, tonight, Stephen Buhner, the music of Yachai. New stuff from them, new stuff from Stephen. Great, all right? 1:15:07 next week, the 15th, Kent Stedman. We were going to have Kevin Warwick, the guy who proposes and promotes cybernetics, essentially, you know, implants and all that stuff. He's a professor at Reading University, and he's the center of a lot of controversy with regard to human enhancement and some of the paradoxical problems that arise with all of this this stuff, you know, technological prosthetic enhancement of human beings. But there's also, you know, major concerns about control and
you know, valid stuff on both sides of the argument as well. Anyway, Kevin Warwick has something that came up. He's going to be traveling. We're not going to be able to do the show with Kevin next week. And I've been wanting to get Kent back on the air. I always like to do something with Kent early in the year to start things off right. Of course, he's my great friend and mentor and someone whom without his help, I would not be, you know, who I am, for good, bad, or ugly. You know, he's a guy that has been a tremendous, tremendous influence and impact on me, and I love him like a brother, a father, something. But he's the man, and he'll be on the show next week on the 15th. Kent Stedman, the brilliant mind behind cyberspaceorbit.com. And you can always find Kent via my site at Mike Hagan, all right? All right, on the 22nd, Star and Michael. Star Newland and Dr. Michael Heisen back on the air. They've been on the program, as you know, a number of times before. We'll talk about dolphins, whales, intelligence, language, spaceflight, lots of stuff. Michael's in the middle of a whole bunch right now. And can't say a whole lot about it, but things are really happening for them, and I'm really pleased because they deserve it more than anyone. And Michael is just in the middle of some amazing work. We'll talk about that on the 22nd of January with Star Newland, Michael Heisen. Of course, on the web, if you want to find information about those two, just hop on and zip over to Planet Puna, PlanetPuna.com, PlanetPuna.com. And I should mention Stephen's site, by the way. We'll be getting to that interview in just a little while here, but Stephen Herod Buhner on the web at www.gaianstudies.org. That's Gaian, G-A-I-A-N, studies, S-T-U-D-I-E-S, GaianStudies.org. Steve's amazing, right? On the 5th of February, on the 29th of January, it's going to be open. I don't know, maybe Kevin Warwick will fit back in there. I don't know, we'll have to see how it works. But if not, we'll come up with something. But the 5th of February, John J. Harper, he's the author of Transformers, Shamans of the 21st Century. Interesting guy. Paul Laffoley, still trying to actually connect and get a date together with Paul Laffoley, the amazing artist. Paul Laffoley should be on the program sometime in the next couple months. I know he has an amazing show that's going to be opening in the spring, and maybe we'll do a program with Paul sometime to correspond with that, but certainly in the next couple months. I haven't mentioned this, but I should. I can't believe I've forgotten, but Judith Ann Brown is a woman who I've been in touch with a number of times now and spoken with her on the phone. She lives in England, and I'd like to have her on the program, and we're going to do it. She is the daughter of John Marco Allegro. And if you don't know who John Marco Allegro is, you should do your homework. He is the author of a number of books, or was, I should say. He's no longer with us. He passed back in 99, I think. Anyway, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, of course, 1970, the book that he wrote that, well, it did a number of things. But we'll speak with his daughter, Judith Ann Brown, who wrote a book of her own. It's called John Marco Allegro, The Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And if you don't know about Allegro's story, it's a fascinating one, and one that deserves some discussion, certainly. All right. So anyway, Judith Ann Brown, leveling the playing field and the historical record on her father, John Marco Allegro, the author of The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, and a number of other books. But he was no fuddy-duddy. He was an amazing, amazing intellect and one of the original team members to decipher and decode the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's just that most people didn't like what he saw there. All right, Dale Pendel, still working things out with Dale. Jim Beard, my Lakota elder and friend, sometime in the next couple months. Dr. Roland Griffiths, I've about given up, but I tried one more time the last week. We'll see what happens. And lots of other good stuff, though, coming as we move into 2007, okay? All right, let's see. About 21 after the hour. Let's play a piece of music here from Yachai. And I may... not sure if I will or not, but anyway, I may read a short piece of poetry that's written by Stephen Buhner over this song, over a short section of it at least, and if it feels right, I'll do it. If not, we'll maybe consider that later in the program, okay? At any rate, this song is called The Archaic Revival. Killer stuff from... this one's actually from Jeff Kerna. This is from Jeff's project that's called Sorcerer. But Jeff and William, you know, involved in all this stuff together and doing great stuff as Yachai or under any other moniker. In this particular case, as I said, this is Sorcerer, and it's called The Archaic Revival. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Back in just a few minutes. There is no place you are not seen. It is not God, but the stones under your feet. The tree leaning casual in shadows, the wolf motionless in moonlight. Your own soul, standing silent in darkness, next to your unconscious self. They're the ones that see you, all of you. In spite of your thinking, yourself safely invisible, these beings, their lives, pull, tug at your tethers, and call you back to suckle in leaf-dappled shadow at the ancient breast that suckled humans long before Jesus saw the light of day, or palmed iron, or Buddha sat, or ate mushrooms, or man walked on the moon. the Archaic Revival. All right, that's Sorcerer, another project from Jeff Kernett. Jeff, of course, one of the members of Yachai. We're featuring music from Jeff and William all night tonight. Yachai Music on the web, www.yachai, W-A-C-H-A-Y-M-U-S-I-C, yachaimusic.com. All right, it's Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN. Speaking of websites, kopn.org. All right, and speaking of KOPN, you are invited to the KOPN annual potluck celebration to be held at the Unity Center. 1600 West Broadway, Sunday, January 21st, doors opening at 3:30 p.m. To be sure that we have a wide variety of foods, bring some. There's a whole hierarchy of rules to let you know what you're supposed to bring, but I'm not going to go into them now. Just bring some food. And we'd love to see you there. It's going to be great music. I'm sort of involved in getting some music together for that, and we'll have some nice piano music during dinner time and some more upbeat stuff a little bit after that. But anyway, good stuff will be happening at 3:30 p.m. and afterward at the Unity Center on January 21st for the KOPN annual meeting. All right, so I hope you guys can make it, all of you. All right, let's see. What else is happening? Well, let's do space weather, okay? Like I said, we'll try to do this interview with Stephen. I think we'll start it at about quarter till. There were some questions as to why we weren't doing the show live tonight. Stephen just is not one for late-night interviews, simple as that. And as hard as I try to get him live, he likes to record stuff beforehand. And it's fine with me because whatever it takes to get these types of people on the air with us, that's what I'll do. All right, space weather. Wow, if you like looking up to the stars, you've been really enjoying yourself over the last couple of days, and it's going to get better for the next week or so. This amazing Comet McNaught, has just over the last 24 hours or so really brightened and is now a naked eye comet, and has been for a little while, but the bottom line is that it is up there in the sky right now, and you can see it. Depends on the timing, of course, but if you hop on the web and go over to spaceweather.com, you'll be able to see a whole bunch of information about this, and it can give you information about where and when to look from your particular location. For the most part, it's going to be evening twilight or early morning, and you'll have to look around, the comet will be just to the right of Venus toward the end of the day if you look west into the twilight, and in the morning it'll hang down there in the east, emerging just above the rising sun, ahead of the rising sun, right? Use your binoculars if you need to, but I mean, there have been some tremendous photographs already taken of this thing, and it's going to continue to brighten over the next few days as it gets closer to the sun. Anyway, lots of people who are watching it are taking photos of it, and a lot of that stuff's up on the web. Going over to cyberspaceorbit.com, I mentioned Kent just a few minutes ago. Kent Stedman, of course, will be on the program next week, and his site, I should say, Cyberspace Orbit, is the place to go if you want to watch the coverage of this comet that we're watching. The comet itself is called C2006P1 McNaught. And the name McNaught is after the astronomer that spotted it. But anyway, there's some great stuff. Listen to this from an astronomer friend who sends this message. Granted, the comet will not be seen outside of twilight, but some of the estimates of what the comet's maximum brightness will be on January 12th and 13th indicate it might be a fairly easily seen object in the evening twilight. Right now, it seems the maximum magnitude might reach -1.5 to -8.7. If the latter is true, the comet would be visible in broad daylight. That's what I'm talking about, huh? I love it. Let's have some broad daylight comets streaking over our heads. That'll get some people's attention, maybe. I don't know. It's sort of like cows. they just sort of glance upward for a few moments and then, drop their heads right back down to continue grazing. But anyway, I'll be looking up for the next few days, and maybe you will too. It's breathtaking, amazing stuff, this comet McNaught. So bright, just shines right through the evening, through the twilight. Lots of great stuff coming from Europe as well. So anyway, get on the web. Hop on over to cyberspaceorbit.com, and you can see a whole bunch of great stuff with regard to this comet. And it's going to be awesome over the next few days because SOHO, the satellite that orbits the sun, is going to be watching. It's going to be awesome. Actually, SOHO orbits the Earth, but it watches the sun. Anyway, all right, let's see what else is happening. The 8th of January, it's the 15th anniversary, as a matter of fact, today of... Well, it was a spaceship that they called Sakigate. It was a Japanese spaceship that was sent up to examine Halley's Comet. And after it did so, it made a couple of other flybys by the Earth before it sort of ran out of fuel. But anyway, that was 15 years ago. Today's also Stephen Hawking's birthday. 65 years old, born in 1942. Let's see, here's one for you. You got the meeting of the minds here in Durham, United Kingdom. The Neutrino Mass Measurements and Their Implications meeting. That's the 10th through the 12th. Got your normal comet and asteroid flybys. Of course, this comet on the 12th that we're talking about just a few minutes ago, Comet C2006P1 McNaught, reaches perihelion on the 12th of January. Perihelion, I mentioned it, I think, a week or two ago. Perihelion means the closest approach to the sun. And whether you're a traditional comet model fan, you know, the icy snowball thing, or if you think comets are more a part of the electric solar system, the electric universe model, either way, they seem to get highly agitated when they approach the sun, and they brighten up considerably, and that's what's going to happen with McNaught. So we'll watch that over the next few days, and like I say, it's going to be cool. Kent and I were talking about how much it reminded us of this comet that we watched a couple of years ago that was, what was it called? V1, I think. Comet V1, I forget the full name, but it was a trip too, and we watched that thing as it went through the field of vision of the SOHO satellite, just like this McNaught's going to do. And it was remarkable. This was back in February, as a matter of fact, of 2003. Comet V1, holy cow, it was amazing. And this one now that we're talking about, what do we got? We had V1, now what do we got? P1? And it promises to be quite a sight as well. So if you're into this sort of stuff, now's a great time to be looking up and to be watching the SOHO satellite and to be watching websites like Kent Stedman's. All right. Let's see. What else we got going up here in the sky? There's some birthdays that aren't really of great note. I have some next week that I'll talk about that I think are some really significant birthdays and death days. The 13th of January, Cassini is going to do another Titan flyby, another maneuver around the moon of Titan, and send back some more information that we won't be able to see. All right. On Tuesday morning, this morning, coming up, if you get up just a few hours, maybe a couple hours before sunrise, you'll see Jupiter a few degrees north of Antares. If you keep your eye on Jupiter as the winter rolls along and spring comes, you'll see it widen the distance between itself and Antares, and it'll start to retrograde back in April. But in the 4 months after that, Jupiter will start to go west against the background. And then in August, it'll end its retrograde and appear again just 5 degrees north of Antares, a little closer than it does right now. Anyway, on Tuesday and Wednesday, you'll also be able to see Mars sort of faint this time of year, about 15 degrees probably to the lower left of Jupiter. All right, on Tuesday, Wednesday, 4 hours after sunset or so, to the east-northeast, you'll find Saturn with Regulus down to the lower left. And speaking of retrograde, Saturn ends its retrograde in April. What else we got going on? Thursday morning, again, about an hour and a half before sunrise or so, Spica will be well up in the south, 3 or 4 degrees to the left of the moon, which will be about half full, the last quarter of the moon, about half full on the 10th. And again, in the early morning hours and in the evening hours, if you're looking to the west and to the east, respectively, you get to see this amazing comet. All right, okay, let's see, what else? Announcements. Well, only one thing I really want to say, a music-related note, a congratulatory note, as a matter of fact. My friends, Lizzie West and Tony Corraldo. Lizzie West and the White Buffalo, you guys have heard them on the program here. They were featured on Friday on Democracy Now, Amy Goodman's program. I don't know if you're familiar with Democracy Now. It's more of a political program than, you know, than my show is. But Amy's, you know, she really does her thing and does a great job often. You know, I don't know if I agree with her all the time, and who do you? But anyway, she's very popular and on radio and television and all over the country and all over the world, as a matter of fact. And anyway, Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Had Lizzie West and Tony Corraldo. One of their songs was played, and they played a bunch of video. I think they played nearly an entire video of the song, 19 Miles to Baghdad. Great song, right? Anyway, good for you guys. Way to go, Lizzie. Way to go, Tony. You know? I love it. And you heard it here first, people, on KOPN and on Radio Orbit, for sure. So, all right, what else? I think that we'll play another song here, and then we will come back with Stephen Herod Buhner, an interview I recorded with Stephen just a few weeks ago, and he's one of my favorite people and just an amazing person and a brilliant, brilliant herbalist and a great poet and has a huge, huge heart. And he's really doing things, in my opinion, that, you know, that are right along the right track. All right. All right. Anyway, that's my opinion. You can give me yours if you want. Just send me a note. This is a song called Island, and it is Yachai from their new project called The Insect Sessions. It is great. All right, back in a minute. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, and we'll have Stephen Herod Buhner in just a few minutes.
Thought I was my shadow in the echo of the sun. So much of my little island. Yet another chance for me to come undone. Unchain my little island. Tell me you unravel in the drama of it all. Escapes your little island. Don't get far in the face of the fall. Come on, let's start an island. Searching at the stopping for a minute, I've been good. Inside my little island. Separate the claws from the cause, affects it all. It does my little island. And I come on down in the echo of the sun again. It pounds my little island. Won't you come on down and show me you're the sun? Come on, let's start an island. And this time and the lessons that it means. So save my little island. And the seasons for the reasons. And they tell me it all means. Anchor, save my island. I can see it in a little total archipelago. Touch your little island. Don't even need to leave it or grieve it all behind. Come on over to my island. And this
I
swear I'll show you mine. Let's join our little island to the land beneath the water, the sound unseen to the deep down anchors of our island. All the fights and the rides and the minds that'll keep up, doesn't matter on our island. Think it's time for a swim, cause high tide's in. Maybe leave our little island. And this time
all right, everybody. Hi, it's Mike. Welcome back to Radio Orbit. My guest is Stephen Herod Buhner. He's an earth poet, an ecologist. He's the author of wonderful books, a brilliant herbalist, and a man who lectures around the country on herbal medicine, the sacredness of plants, and intelligence in nature. He's a favorite guest here on the program, and we'll waste no more time. And so, Stephen, thanks, as always, for being on Radio Orbit.
No, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Yep, it's great to have you, and the audience is always always pleased to hear your voice coming through the airwaves. I get a lot of response, good response, after you've been on the air. So
great, thanks.
Speaking of that, I did have a few comments from audience members. I mentioned on the air, you know, for the last few weeks that I'm going to be talking to you. So I get some email from people saying, hey, could you maybe mention this to Stephen or that? So I'd like to start off just maybe following up on a few things that came up the last time we spoke on the air, actually, when you and Dennis were on the air together.
Sure, that'd be great.
Okay, first things first, there was a lot of interest in Lyme disease. From people that actually had experience with it and from people who were a little nervous about it or whatever. But there were people very interested in the work that you had done with Lyme disease, in particular this idea of Japanese knotweed that seems to sort of follow it around. So maybe you could expand a little bit on that and tell us what you found in the last, I don't know, 9 or 10 months since we've spoken.
Well, what's interesting, just to kind of give them a little broader perspective on it, that herbalists and physicians from antiquity and then indigenous cultures, as well as folk and community herbalists in this country, have remarked, you know, for centuries on the fact that when a person needs a plant, it begins showing up.
Yeah.
And it's there in your front yard or close by. And the natives would say things like, when a person needs a plant, it will stand up in the forest and begin calling to them.
Right.
So, that kind of dynamic and the subtle interactions about how plants appear, I talked about a lot in the book Lost Language of Plants,
mm-hmm.
how plants maintain ecosystem health and their medicinal qualities are there. They actually begin to produce new species, new chemicals, and begin to appear when they're needed to keep that kind of balance. So with Lyme disease, one of the fascinating things I found about that is that this supposedly invasive botanical Japanese knotweed shows up in many of the places that Lyme becomes endemic. And all along the East Coast, from Virginia all the way up into Canada, it kind of follows that expansion of Lyme disease into human communities. And, of course, the people are all busy eradicating it and hating it and doing all of this stuff
right.
without realizing that it's the primary plant beyond anything else for dealing with Lyme infections, and it basically shuts down almost all, or basically all that I can find of the inflammatory pathways that the Lyme bacteria initiates.
So it effectively mitigates the problem.
Yeah, basically when people take that plant, it covers so many systems of activation in the body by the bacteria that their symptoms begin to alleviate or go into remission, and I've just seen astonishing results from it.
Huh. How do you prepare the knotweed?
Well, it's the root that's used, and, you know, it's oddly enough, though this isn't well known, There's this substance called resveratrol, which is huge in the news right now because it has been found in red wine and from grapes, and it, you know, has some impacts on extending longevity and helping immune function and all kinds of things. But the plant that has more of it than any other plant I've been able to find is the root of Japanese knotweed. So
interesting.
And I, as time has gone on, I've gotten a lot more interested in taking whole plant preparations rather than tinctures or something like that. And so I usually recommend that people get, they can actually harvest the plant, dry the root, powder it, and encapsulate it themselves. And they'd take 3 to 4 of those capsules 3 to 4 times a day, basically. And but for a lot of people with Lyme disease, they have a lot of cognitive difficulties, and so I usually recommend that they buy a thing that's called resveratrol by Source Naturals, and they actually prepare it from whole Polygonum cuspidatum root, which is the Japanese knotweed, and it's an extremely good preparation, and so it's fairly easy to use. And one of the things I like that's not very well known is that plants' chemical constituents change from ecosystem to ecosystem in which they grow.
The same species of plant, you mean?
Pardon me?
The same species of plant, you
mean? Yeah, the same species of plant. And each Lyme disease case is kind of unique. And I'm finding that the chemical constituents in knotweed that grows where a particular kind of Lyme is emergent tends to be more effective for that, those people. Than
very interesting.
Yeah.
What do you make of it? I mean, The fact that this is considered an invasive plant to begin with, in other words, it's not supposed to be indigenous, right?
Right.
So how did, what do you make of it? How did they get there to begin with, Steve?
Well, part of the way that they got here, you know, is that human beings brought them for erosion control or because they looked pretty. And the thing is, a lot of these plants, they don't like being caged up or domesticated, and they tend to escape. For instance, one of my favorite plants is Siberian ginseng or Luthrococcus, which is a native to Russia and China. And it's this, the common name for it is touch me not or devil's shrub over there because it has these enormous spines and it's extremely intimidating. But it's one of the best general immune tonics that exists. And so many growers brought it to this country and said, oh, we'll grow our own. And, of course, it immediately escaped and is spreading around the country, you know, with wild abandon. And the thing is, I wonder from these things a lot, and this is not a new point. Other people have brought it up. But whether we're actually in charge of the plants or whether they're in charge of us, they kind of seem to use us to spread themselves around the earth. And they've got these agendas that are tremendously different than our own human concerns, and they tend to move through ecosystems in ways that people that have studied have found that, you know, it's not random. There's specific reasons behind it, even if we don't understand them.
Amazing. Yeah, we have this, you know, we're so anthropocentric for the most part that we, I mean, the idea of a plant kingdom having an agenda is considered outrageous in most circles.
Well, you know, it's, you know, I love Goethe, the German poet, and he did such great work with plants, which most people don't realize. And he said this great thing, which I find more and more true the older I get. He said, we learn so much only because we know so little. Everything that we've discovered has been discovered before. And the fact that plants are intelligent beings, that they have highly sophisticated nervous systems, in many instances as elegant and sophisticated as our own, they show intent and intelligence and purpose, is just something that people have known in the past, but they don't know now because we're trained to think of them as these kind of things that sit around, you know.
You know, I'd like it if you talk about this a little bit. There was this book, and you and I have spoken about it before, but we never really got into it. And I know it's one that you read probably a long time ago, but it was Peter Tompkins' book.
Secret Life of Plants?
Yeah, The Secret Life of Plants, Peter Tompkins, and I think he had a partner writing it.
Christopher Bird, I think.
Yes, that's exactly right. Now, the way that that book starts out, if I remember, is about this guy who, I forget his name, but he was a man who ran lie detector machines.
Oh yeah, that guy Clive Baxter.
Baxter, yeah.
And
he, maybe you could just, I don't know, tell us a little bit about what came out of that book for you, because I know it must have touched you, because it blew me away when I read it.
Well, I read that book when it first came back out back in the 70s, and it was completely mind-opening for me. And in rereading it now, I think that there's a lot of limitations in the book, but from the place I was beginning, it mm-hmm. was revelatory.
And that's amazing that it seems limiting now, because at the time, me too, I mean, it was just like, oh my gosh.
Well, it was astonishing, but, you know, I read it, I think, when I was 23 or something, and I hadn't really recovered from being raised in suburbia on television and white bread, you know. So I thought, wow, there's other things out there. This is amazing.
Right.
And but Clive Baxter did this really interesting thing. He began hooking plants up to lie detectors, and then he would do things like he would approach the plant with a match to burn its leaf, and the plant would show fear on the lie detector and extreme agitation. And so he found that even after a while, that if he even had the thought that he was going to harm the plant would show agitation on the lie detector. And this sort of thing actually really wasn't all that new, because Jagadish Bose in India in the early 1900s, and who had won the Nobel Prize for this work, had shown that plants' nervous systems were extremely sophisticated, and they had tremendous powers of movement and tremendous powers of perception. Oh, I mean, one of the things that stands out for me in his work, he found that if he put a big tent around a tree, a big giant tree, and then put chloroform in the tent, that the plant would go comatose, and then they could transplant it, and it wouldn't go into shock.
Really?
Yeah, which I thought was fascinating. He also found that if he gave plants alcohol, they would get drunk. So that, you know, apples that fall on the ground around apple trees and then ferment, you know, everybody knows, oh, bees and birds will get drunk on them. But the fact is the tree gets drunk on it as well.
Hmm.
So this kind of material, which I talk a little bit about in Secret Teachings of Plants,
right,
to some extent, with Luther Burbank's work and Gerda's work and Jagadish Bose, all of these people have found tremendous intelligence and responsiveness in plants. And the neat thing about The Secret Life of Plants, it kind of brought that information back for a new generation of people who'd been taught, you know, that the world is just a bunch of resources for our extraction.
Right.
And so it's this burst in our awareness of, oh, my goodness, this is really amazing. But what that book basically talked about is many of the tremendous subtle perceptions and interactions that plants have with human beings and in the ecosystem. And, of course, if we begin to accept that plants are intelligent like us, not really different except in their form of expression, it changes everything. You know, James Hillman had a great quote. He said, only when science convinced us that the world was dead could they begin their autopsy in earnest.
Isn't that the truth? Stephen, who was Luther Burbank?
Well, Luther Burbank, and it's astonishing that no one really knows who he is anymore except people in their 50s and older, he was considered the plant wizard of Menlo Park in California. The town of Burbank was named after him, and his first big claim to fame was he invented the Idaho potato, which at the time was called the Burbank potato.
That's right.
And nearly all of the vegetables that we and fruits that we eat were actually co-created by him with the plants he worked with. And he was as famous as Thomas Edison in his day, kings and princes, famous writers. Jack London used to go down and hang out with him. And I mean, he was as well known as Edison, one of the most famous people in the world. And, you know, what he said he would do is that somebody would come to him and say, I need a vegetable like blah, blah, blah. And so he'd say, okay, come back in a couple of years and I'll have it for you. And what he would do is that he said, heredity is nothing more than stored environment. And he could look at a plant and see any form it had grown in its entire evolutionary history. And then he would essentially talk to the plant and urge that one form to come back out of its hereditary structure and begin to manifest itself and breed true. And that's how he did all of the work. And he, kept copious notes, and, you know, I forget how many plants that he created, 140, something like that.
Oh, my God. So he basically was bringing back plants that have existed another time.
Right. You know, like, for instance, he created a prickly poppy that doesn't have, I'm not sorry, a prickly pear plant that does not have spines.
And
this, it's actually grows quite a bit down here in southern New Mexico, and it's really prevalent in Israel, where they use it as a foraging crop for animals.
And prior to this, it didn't exist?
No.
And he wasn't doing any genetic work or anything like that?
No, not at all.
Amazing. Well, okay, you mentioned New Mexico. That's another thing that comes up before we get too deeply into the conversation here. You moved. Last time we spoke, you were in Vermont. You've been there for quite a while. You're now in New Mexico. Maybe tell people a little bit about what you're up to.
Well, we basically have been environmental refugees fleeing overpopulation, you know. And we've been looking for some place that seems like it's going to stay kind of stable for a while that way. And we left Boulder, Colorado 12 years ago, kind of on a search for this place, and finally found it. Right now I'm restoring a 4,000 square foot adobe house, which is taking a lot of the time. But we have some acreage up in the middle of the Gila Wilderness, which is about 3.3 million acres, and
Wow. It
has a virtually no human footprint up there. So I'm working once again with very ancient wild plant populations, and that's a lot of what I'm looking at now is kind of an extension of the work from Secret Teachings of Plants and moving into the geography of the sacred in those kind of wild ecosystems.
So maybe you could expand on that a little bit. For example, you're getting to know and learning about and creating relationships with the plants that are now in your local environment.
Right, and basically I found over the years that it takes me a year just to adjust to the new ecosystem that I'm in. And then the next year, I pretty much begin seeing what's right in front of me, which is, I find that's the most difficult thing of all for me, is to see what's clearly in front of me. And it seems to be a human difficulty, not really specific to me.
Yeah, I would agree, for sure.
And then the third year, I'm able to really begin developing intensive relationship with new plant populations. And some of these overlap with the plants that I knew in the high Colorado mountains, but many of them don't. The desert ecosystem is very different. For instance, oak trees here are prevalent, but their leaf structure looks more like a small holly leaf than it does an oak leaf.
Really?
Yeah, they're very different. And many of the plants here are much more potent. They tend to be extremely high in chemical constituents, and because they're wild plants, they're even stronger. So a lot of it is learning about the way these new ecosystems think, really, and the way the plants think in this place. John Seed, the rainforest activist from Australia, mentioned that this one culturally where he worked with in South America, they said the rainforest plants are not only good to eat, but also good to think. And I found that to be so, that each ecosystem has its own particular kind of intelligence and awareness. And as I move into them, it's more like I begin adapting myself to its personality, and then over time I begin to learn to think the way it thinks. And each shift like that creates a subtle alteration in the way I perceive reality. It's almost like a language, even though it doesn't use words as we know of them.
You know, I'd like to sort of ask your advice on a personal basis about something and share something maybe with the audience that will help other people. I am basically a city person as well, and I've spent time in Colorado like you, although I really wasn't out in nature. I was in Denver for the most part for 15 years. I lived in Chicago for a long time before that, but I've lived in other places around the world. And I've always been in sort of a metropolitan setup. When I moved to Missouri, we moved here 4 years ago, and about 3.5 years ago, we bought a small piece of property that's out in the country for the first time. It's basically, you know, a dream for me. I'd always wanted to, but never had the opportunity to. But anyway, we bought a small piece of land, you know, 7 or 8 acres, and we have a nice home that's on it, and there's some water there, and lots of wildlife and lots of trees, and it's kind of wild, you know. We didn't pay a lot of money for it because it hadn't been taken great care of for a long time, and anyway, there's all kinds of things that I'm completely unfamiliar with, you know.
But I'm trying to get more familiar, and it's really difficult, to be honest with you. But at the same time, I feel that it's a welcoming sort of thing. I mean, I guess I'm looking for advice on, you know, how do you actually do it?
Well, the answer is simple, even though it's difficult to carry into practice. And the thing that I've been telling people for a very long time, and I can't emphasize it enough, is the most important thing is to pay attention to your feelings.
Hmm.
One of the major problems in our time now is there's such a tremendous disconnect between our feelings and our thinking. And most of us have been trained to disregard our feelings.
Right.
And many of our feelings that come up, we disregard them or discount them. So we spend a lot of time walking around with a confused look on our face. And what happens when a person goes into an ecosystem like you're describing is that the ecosystem itself is going to be in one state or another of wholeness, just like all human beings are. So many ecosystems have been damaged by technology, so that does create an impact. Nevertheless, there's a drive toward health and a power in ecosystems and in wild landscapes that is very different than the human. Nevertheless, it's the kind of thing we came out of in our evolutionary history and designed naturally to be able to respond to the language that comes out of those places. So the way we get in touch with the communications from those places is through our feelings. So, you know, many people, when they learn to be herbalists, for instance, they might go on an herb walk with somebody
mm-hmm.
who has a really enlarged neocortex, you know, and the person will tell them, you know, 100 plants on the walk. Well, people can't retain that. It's
right.
useless data, you know. It's mm-hmm. just information stream.
Mm-hmm.
But when I work with somebody, because I found this was true of me, I may teach an apprentice only maybe 5 plants in a year. And normally what I encourage them to do is to learn the plants that for whatever reason they're drawn to, that they have a feeling about. So when somebody has new plant land or new wild land like you're talking about,
uh-huh.
they'll be drawn to certain parts of it, maybe a
oh
rock
my gosh,
formation
I can't
or a
believe
certain
you
tree or a certain community of plants. And that's the place you always begin because there's something about it that is calling to you and some deep part of you responds.
Well, I have to tell you something, Stephen. In the spring of last year, in April, okay, it was maybe the 1st of April, and I was down by the lake. We have a small lake. Well, I mean, people might call it a pond. I call it a lake. Anyway, there's this little patch of land that's just off of the edge of a lake, and for whatever reason, I was drawn to this little area of land, and I looked at it, and I mean, I've never done this before, but I gathered up a bunch of leaves. I'd been raking leaves and trying to clean up a little bit, you know, and I raked a bunch of leaves over there, and it was maybe an area that was maybe 5 or 6, you know, feet, maybe 5 or 6 feet square, and I cleared it off. I put a bunch of leaves on it, and I burned them, and it sort of cleared this area because there had been cattails there and a whole, you know, it was just sort of wild. Anyway, I cleared it, and then a couple days later, I was absolutely compelled to go and plant some seeds there. And I did. And I took care of the plants that grew there all summer.
That's great.
And it was so weird. It had never happened to me before, and it was like a great, great experience. And the fact that you said that you might be drawn to a certain place, it's really struck me because, I mean, I was drawn to this particular spot on our land.
And that's the way it works with everybody. I mean, we're made to be that way. And when that begins to happen to me, I follow that thing, and quite often I'll sit with it for a long time because it takes a while, I found, for the understanding of what that place is trying to tell me to come into my awareness enough for me to articulate it and then to be able to respond meaningfully. It's one of the things that, for whatever reason, just in my own makeup, when I left home when I was 16, that I pretty much rejected most of the assumptions that I could mind that I had about things, because mm-hmm. I realized I didn't really know very much. And I learned to approach ecosystems without any assumptions at all, realizing they've been here for millions of years and
right,
I haven't.
Right.
And so I had to learn how to intentionally become ignorant and allow myself to be ignorant. And I found that to be a hard thing, because there's so much drive and pressure on all of us to know things, because we value knowledge so much in this culture. And somebody that's kind of ignorant is in many ways an object of derision. We don't have permission to go, I don't know.
Right.
And so allowing myself to do that, I allowed the communication from those places and those plants to emerge in me as they reached a certain kind of maturation. And sometimes these things I would sit with for many years, sometimes it would only take a few months. But mm-hmm. what started to happen was that there's an intimacy that's created between the human being and the plant, or the human being and the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And like any relationship, it needs time to grow. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I lived in Colorado at that high elevation, after a decade of that, I knew where all of the plants were, and I could harvest them in any time of year. If it was, you know, in the middle of winter with snow on the ground, I still knew where they were because I had such a deep relationship with them. And slowly, the human being begins to reintegrate into the landscape, to, as John Seed calls it, re-inhabit our inner being with the world.
Right.
And that's kind of the thing that I was going for, because I knew indigenous and ancient cultures, they knew something we'd forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that thing that I was interested in. How did they immerse themselves in a landscape and begin to think the plants and think the landscape? And that's the thing that really, I mean, that's the thing that turns me on more than almost anything else.
Right, and it sounds like you're approaching that sort of an environment now again as you've found your new place there in New Mexico.
Yeah, we have. And the last 10 years that we moved from eastern Washington and then to Vermont and then to here, the interesting thing, it was like being in kind of a graduate school, really, because the first place we went, they'd cut down many of the trees in the forest, and, you know, intense fires began to burn, and I got to see how that impacted living beings that were in that place. They go into kind of a shock when the trees are cut, and it takes about 6 weeks for them to recover, but of course that's when the next logging would begin. And so we went through that for quite a few years there.
Do you mean the animals in the area or the other plants?
Everything. All life forms in the area where trees are logged go into kind of a shock.
Human beings included.
And trees are, as Brooke Medicine Eagle says in my first book, Sacred Plant Medicine,
which I'm reading right now.
Right, she said, the trees are the teachers of the law. And this statement of hers is one of the most beautiful I've ever heard. She said, the trees are the teachers of the law. My elders have taught me this. And as I become less ignorant, I begin to understand what they mean.
Wonderful. Yeah, she wrote the foreword to that book.
Yeah, she did. And that concept of allowing oneself to be ignorant and sit with a piece of wisdom like that is tremendous.
Mm.
And the thing about trees, people know this instinctively. There's some power in them beyond many of the other plants that grow in ecosystems. Ecologists sometimes refer to them as keystone species, depending upon what tree and what ecosystem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they really create archipelagos of life wherever they grow. And whenever the trees are cut off, I mean, Thoreau said this a long time ago. He said, all civilizations that cut off their trees fall.
Fall. Yeah, a culture is only as strong as its wood.
Yeah, that's a good...
I forget who said it, but I heard that as well. Gosh, all right, so it leads me to another question, which is relevant to me as well. How do you approach the cutting of a tree? In other words, there are certain parts of the land that I steward. I don't call it my land because I don't own the land, you know. But the place that we have the privilege to live now,
right.
We have a small... For example, there's a small area where I built a play set for my son, who's 3 years old, right? And it's beautiful, and it's right enclosed in a nice little grove of trees, but I had to cut down some small trees in order to make room for his playset. I should rephrase, Stephen. I didn't have to. I did, right? But I felt it when I did it, and I used those trees to make a circle around his play area, and I sort of considered a place that, you know, their bodies protect him while he's there. Is there a way that we can do this with reverence, or are we not supposed to touch?
Well, you know, Masanobu Fukuoka, the great Japanese farmer, struggled with that a lot. He had these visions when he was a young man, even though he trained in agricultural farming, one of them was he was walking along one day and he stopped by this tree, and all of a sudden he realized that that tree grew without pruning, without planting, without fertilizers, and just the power of the earth flowing through it.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this whole vision about how to do natural farming, which took him most of his life to figure out how to do elegantly. And he said when he began, he did not know the difference between natural and abandonment. Mm-hmm. And that's a tremendously potent realization. I mean, many of the people from the 60s, because of the ways they were raised, they didn't want their children to be raised that way, but they didn't understand the difference between natural child rearing and abandonment.
Uh-huh.
And the difference between setting limits and being unkind.
Uh-huh.
So when we approach an ecosystem that we're working with and we want to do things with the plants, the thing at age of 54 that I've learned is to wait. And I generally wait at least a year before I do anything so that I can adapt to the place and really begin to see what's there. But the second thing, when I do find that I want to remove some plants, it's very similar to, I'm sure, something many of your listeners have seen in movies where natives will hunt a buffalo or kill them and then they pray with its spirit.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly that process. Before I do that, I talk to the trees, I talk to the spirit of the trees, explain what I'm going to do, and ask for their participation. And
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
plants are some of the most giving life forms on earth.
Certainly.
And in many instances, they will agree to be taken, and you can feel this kind of acceptance at this certain point. A few of them will say, no, absolutely not, and I tend to leave those. But
uh-huh.
many of them will agree. And that kind of approach of approaching another living organism and saying, I need to take your life, and you go through this kind of grieving process,
uh-huh.
and the trees are very giving about that usually.
Very interesting. Yeah, it is reminiscent of the native ways before they would take an animal. And they said in many times the animal, and they would make eye contact, et cetera, and basically there was that gift.
I mean, I've seen this with sometimes with chickens or with rabbits, where a native person goes to kill them and will pray with it. And I've literally seen the animal tilt its head to offer its neck to the knife.
Amazing. Remarkable, Steve.
It's an astonishing experience.
All right, everybody. Hi, it's Mike. And
all right, speaking of sacred plant medicine,
we're going to take a little break here, and we'll come back with the second half of this interview with Stephen Herod Buhner. And in the meantime, we'll play a piece of music here from Yachai. Actually, I think we're going to play another one off of Sorcerer. But let me take care of a little bit of business here real fast, okay? This program is brought to you by listener support and a donation from professional counselor, marital and family therapist Betty Acree. Ms. Acree counsels individuals, couples, and children. She also works on anxiety issues, depression, and trauma. Her practice is devoted to aiding people to heal old wounds that are getting in the way of their present lives. Information on services is available at 573-256-2914. All right, yeah, it's me and it's you and Stephen Herod Buhner and Yachai Music and Sorcerer. Check it out. We'll be back in a minute or four or so, and then we'll continue on with Stephen Herod Buhner. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. Back in just a little while. Okay. All right, that's animals are something invented by plants to move seeds around. Sorcerer. And this is Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia 89.5 FM. We'll get right back to it now with Stephen Herod Buhner.
All right, speaking of sacred plant medicine, I want to mention your books, and I want to mention the website real fast. It's still GaianStudies.org, I think.
That's it.
All right, www.Gaian, G-A-I-A-N, studies.org. You can find information there about Stephen. And Trishua is still working with you, obviously.
Yes, Trishua and our new partner, Julie.
Wonderful. What's Julie do for you?
Julie is, she's astonishing. She's a wonderful plant person and herbalist. She's worked actually for many years doing ceremonies with native men in prison, and she works a lot with young women. And for instance, she's doing a wonderful thing next year called Wild Women, Wild Food, which is gathering wild foods for 10 days on our land up there, and that's all that they eat.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Stephen is the author of many books, among them The Lost Language of Plants, The Secret Teachings of Plants, and this one that I'm reading right now, which is actually one of your, maybe your first one, Sacred Plant Medicine.
Right. It was my first book.
All right. The subtitle is Wisdom, The Wisdom in Native American Herbalism. And the reason I grabbed it, I've had it on my shelf for a while, but a friend of mine, this is another strange story, but you'll love it, sent me an email a couple weeks ago and asked me if I could find something for her. And it's an old chart that was called the Herb and Ailment Cross-Reference Chart. And it was made by this guy named Les Kasloff in 1972. And, Stephen, it's about 3 feet wide and about 5 feet high. And it's a handwritten or drawn, basically, cross-reference matrix of every plant you could ever imagine and every ailment you could ever imagine.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it's beautifully illustrated. He's drawn, hand-drawn, you know, pictures of the leaves and flowers of all of these different plants. And anyway, I found one on the web. I bought it for $10. And I just received it a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to have it framed. It's old and beat up, but I'm going to try to have it cleaned up and framed. But anyway, I realized how much we have lost, and how much, in other words, the plants can do everything, it seemed to me, when I read this.
They can. They're, you know, that's the thing about plant medicines. Many people don't realize that human beings used them for their primary medicines for, you know, however long you want to assume human beings have been around, 1 million years, 100,000 years, whatever the particular number that turns you on.
Mm-hmm.
But pharmaceuticals have only really been around since World War II, about 1946. There were a few exceptions that came in earlier. And in some instances, pharmaceuticals are really effective in an extremely intense, acute situation where you need to reduce some sort of a condition extremely fast, mm-hmm, to save somebody's life or prevent really severe disability. They're really effective. But the thing that most people don't realize, you know, I see this all of the time with agricultural activists and environmental activists. They don't like all of these chemicals being put on lawns or fields, but they're perfectly fine to take them inside themselves, you know, because we've all been trained to be afraid of dying.
Right.
And the thing about this, I mean, one of the greatest things that Woodward and Bernstein ever did in Watergate was to say, follow the money.
Mm, isn't that the truth?
If you begin to follow the money, you find out that pharmaceutical companies are the most profitable corporations on the planet. And look, they are not in the business of doing this so that they won't have any more business. The money is in the medicine, not in the cure.
Right.
They have a vested interest in herbs continually being denigrated and relegated to some sort of superstitious place. But having worked as an herbalist for 20 years and known hundreds of the best herbalists in this country and a number of them in Europe, the outcomes that we generally get in our practice is consistently better than the outcomes that pharmaceutical-oriented physicians get in their practice. You know, the underlying conditions are cured. There's very few side effects. There's not any environmental pollution. I mean, most people don't realize that pharmaceuticals don't biodegrade very easily.
Oh,
and they
man.
Go into the environment. They continue to affect all living organisms that they come in contact with. So this kind of thing is astonishing to me, that in this country, supposedly this tremendously free democracy, we have kind of a medical totalitarianism. And yes, as you were saying, plants are exceptionally good for the ailments that human beings have, and with rare instances, they're much better for people in pharmaceuticals.
Right. Would you consider that most diseases that we might consider uncurable are probably curable?
Well, there's two parts to that thing. The very first thing to realize is that human beings are designed to be biodegradable.
That's right. We're going to die.
That's right. And no matter what scientists or doctors do, there's always going to be a leading cause of death. So one of the things that has been done to us as a people in this country that's a real disservice is we've been trained to believe somehow that we're entitled to a life without suffering. And so, but that's not the way life is. All of us experience that, and we're meant to biodegrade. We're meant to go. I mean, so many environmental activists, they are really into, you know, sustainable housing, but sustainable human population is the same. Some of us must pass. All of us must pass in a certain period of time. So on the one hand, death is inevitable, so you have to recognize the two different conditions. One, the inevitable biodegradability of human beings, but the second one is a disease that is intended to be cured and helped.
Mm-hmm.
In that kind of a condition, situation, there are plants that will deal with all of the ones of which I'm aware. Nevertheless, there's a caveat to that. You know, many of the things I've learned as a human being that have formed my character and helped me become who I am are the result of different disease conditions, whether they're physical, emotional, or spiritual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's nothing like a good chronic disease to enhance human awareness.
Right.
And so then I guess there would be a third category of diseases that are intended to be teachings. And those things do in time become healed, but we are different people at the moment that it is healed.
I see. So with regard to infectious disease, you know, I know you follow a lot of that. What do you see happening on the planet right now?
Well, human population problems have a horrible way of solving themselves.
Who said that?
You know, Robert Heinlein said that.
That's great, Robert Heinlein.
The master of gaudily embellished understatement, as L. Sprague de Camp called him. But that's the thing. We've exceeded the carrying capacity of the Earth, and no matter how much we want to pretend that we have some sort of Disney-esque right to inhabit this fairyland place, that's not the way it works, you know. You exceed the carrying capacity of the Earth at your peril, and so the ecosystem begins to initiate balancing dynamics, and part of that process is disease. Now, we've erected an artificial barrier around the human species over the last 60 years from the use of pharmaceuticals, and it's just like a dam or anything else. There's tremendous pressure against that wall all of the time, or it's like using pharmaceuticals on crops. The first year you get a really good response, and the next year it's pretty good, but then the ecosystem begins to adapt.
So it starts to require more and more and more.
And eventually what happens is the amount of energy needed to sustain what you're doing exceeds the available energy that you have. And then the system collapses and you get these wild gyrations as the ecosystem begins to reestablish homeostasis, or homeodynamics is more accurate. So we're actually in that kind of period now with pharmaceuticals, and we're about to experience these wild gyrations. So I've been looking at infectious diseases for a long time, and I've watched them follow the predictions of epidemiologists from 20, 30 years ago as to how fast they'll be emerging into the population, like systemic antibiotic-resistant staph is more and more common now. Now, I use an herb called Cryptolepsis sanguinolenta from Western Africa, from Ghana, to treat it, and it's very easy to treat if you use proper dosages and everything. And But nevertheless, we see all of the time in the paper more and more infection in our food supply, more and more unusual things like West Nile or avian flu. After a while, these things are just going to break out in the human population. Epidemiologists are clear. It's not a matter of whether or not they're going to happen,
it's
but when they're going to happen.
Right, right. Well, let me ask you a question then, sort of a philosophical one. It seems that you mentioned once before when you were on the program that many of the people who take some of your classes and visit your lectures seem to be herbalists in training or but in hiding as well. You said a lot of them turn out to be suburban housewives and this sort of thing.
Yeah, they're disguised as housewives, right, and pharmacists and auto mechanics and bakers.
Do you think they're
spread all through the country now.
So the question is, do you think that this wall that you're talking about, the dam that's about ready to break, regardless of when, do you think that it's almost an evolutionary thing, that the people that and the plants and the animals that are able to make it through the gate will be the ones that are closer to the earth and that have knowledge and access to the plant medicines?
Actually, you know, I used to think more that way, but as my perception of the complexity of ecosystem dynamics has evolved, it's more because I realize the inevitability of dying.
Mm-hmm.
Then I don't look at it with quite the same fearful perspective I had before. And, you know, the human species is going to endure. We're incredibly capable
as
a species. And it's human civilization. I mean, civilization means of the cities. I mean, I don't know that the cities will necessarily endure, but the human species will. And
and
so what I mostly see are complex ecosystem movements that are difficult to see because we're too close to the trees to see the forest most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So at the same time these diseases are growing in resistance to antibiotics and new ones crop up, I see at the same time this kind of hidden movement of herbalists growing in the United States and in many places around the world. They're kind of like Japanese knotweed. They're treated shabbily. They want, you know, people want to eradicate them. They think they don't do anything and that they're horrible. The mainstream culture often treats them that way, but nevertheless, there's this hidden power in there.
And they keep popping up everywhere.
They pop up everywhere, and they're a very different kind of person. They are the servant of the plants. They've been healed by the earth, and once that happens, everything changes.
Oh, boy. That's a wonderful place maybe to jump into some of the Native American and the indigenous traditions.
Yeah.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. This book that I'm reading right now called Sacred Plant Medicine, you talk a lot about native traditions and the knowledge and the relationships with plants that those people have and had and how powerful that was.
Well, they lived in an entirely different world than we do. And the framework that they were immersed in, the worldview as they grew up was substantially different. They saw the world as a living place, not because somebody told them, but because that's every day showed them that. So Wallace Stevens, I think it was, said this remarkable thing that has really impacted me. He said, "As surely as the Indian names remain on the land, they remain inside us. We go along every day not realizing that we have been subsumed by what we conquered."
Wow.
People in the United States, if you ask them, and I did this for many years, I would tell people, what are the holy? They would always say the Grand Canyon, Redwoods, Yosemite, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You ask people in Europe, they never say a natural formation. They say, oh, this church is over there, this temple is over there. We have more of that world inside of us than
No. It's true, and the names. That's a wonderful observation. You know, I live here in Missouri. This is Plains Indian land. You know,
right.
And I can't tell you how many times I drive over the crest of a hill and I see a subdivision titled Lakota Ridge or something like this. You know,
but it's even more names of streets, names of towns,
names of rivers
everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Right, and it's on the one hand, it gives me sort of a you know, a knot in my stomach. It makes me mad because I know too much about the history, and I have some native blood in my own family. And at the same time, I see what you're saying, that it hasn't disappeared, even though it may be manifesting itself in strange ways.
And there's more of that perspective inside of us than we know. There, in a sense, the European culture ate the native cultures here, but once they did that, it got inside of them. And like any kind of food, it began to change their sinews and their muscles and their very cognition.
Just like when we eat a plant.
Just like when we eat a plant. And those things are there. I see it in so many people that they're drawn to native practices because something in them tells them that there's something there they must know to be a whole human being.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, when I began first working with plants, you know, I took this plant. Somebody happened to mention to me that OSHA was good for intestinal cramping, and I was having incredibly severe experiences, something like appendicitis. And so I ate this plant, and the attacks began to lessen in severity, but at the same time I could feel this living organism, this living being inside of me with intelligence
really
communicating with me. I'd never had such an experience, and I didn't really know where to go to find out more about that, but slowly I began to find original interviews with indigenous medicine people in the Americas from the late 19th century and early 20th century. People who had grown up never knowing white people. And their descriptions of their experiences were identical to the ones I was having. And I began to then see that there was some definite map of this territory I was going into, that people had been there before me,
right,
over thousands and of generations even. And that's what that book was designed to do, to create a map of the territory of what Mircea Eliade called plant hierophanies, are the sacred teachings that plants could offer human beings.
Hmm. You know, you mentioned that OSHA was a plant that actually communicated with you internally.
Yeah.
Most people wouldn't, maybe with a psychedelic plant, that might be something that you would consider, but a lot of people wouldn't imagine that with other types of plants. Is that something that could be common? Again, is it just openness?
Well, my experience is that all plants are psychotropic. It's just that certain ones are extremely insistent and loud. Because, you know, we've had this habituated not noticing that has emerged over years of indoctrination. I mean, people forget that we have been colonized, too.
Hmm.
Just that our colonization has been longer and more deep. So, like the way plants break through sidewalks, that green or viriditas, as Hildegard of Bingen called it, it breaks through inside of us. You know, John Seed has this great thing. He says, you know, there were these sisters that, you know, wanted to reclaim their ecosystem in Australia. So they hit on this plan of each spring they would go and they would remove the exotic species, the invasive botanicals. That's all they would do. And then slowly, years into the process, plants long thought extinct in that part of Australia began to emerge of their own accord.
Amazing.
And John says, you know, this is much more than a story of ecological reclamation. If we go inside ourselves and remove the introduced beliefs one by one, capabilities and perceptions long thought lost in the human species begin to reemerge of their own accord.
Hmm, wonderful. And good advice.
It is good advice.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about, I know you're editing a new book right now. Let's talk a little bit what that's about.
Well, I'm actually working on a book for men that is about endocrine disruptors in the environment and how these endocrine disruptors are damaging male reproductive systems throughout the world. It doesn't really matter whether they're turtles or panthers or human beings. The disruptions are extremely severe. And there's been a lot of work done on estrogenic plants for women, what might be called phytoestrogens, and to help them with the transition into midlife and also to normalize the reproductive systems. But nothing had been done on it for men, and so I started realizing that there's also a class of plants called phytoandrogens, which have androgenic substances in them, like testosterone, and there's many plants that have the exact same testosterone in them that we have in our body, so that it helps normalize these problems in men. And interestingly, the most powerful plant that I've found so far with testosterone in it is pine trees.
Right, you mentioned that once before.
Yeah, which in Germany, I think it's hilarious, they pronounce the Latin as penis sylvestris, which I think is completely humorous.
Right.
So that's basically what I'm working on now, and it's an area of real interest to me because when I moved through my own midlife shift, I noticed a lot of hormonal disruption, and this has actually helped it a lot.
All right. You know, there's another note that I made that I want to bring back up in the conversation. You mentioned earlier that many of the pharmaceuticals aren't biodegradable. They get released through our urine and whatever right back into the environment, and they continue along their way. You make an amazing analysis of this in The Lost Language of Plants, and I'd like you to talk about that a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, just about how much of this stuff is being introduced into the environment that we have little or nothing that we can do about.
There's millions and millions of tons, and I don't remember the exact figures on a lot of it now. I haven't looked at the data in a long time. I don't tend to remember numbers as well as I did 20 years ago. But it's literally the millions of tons. And the thing is, all life forms on Earth come from similar beginnings. You know,
right, bacteria.
The reason why a female reproductive system looks exactly like the reproductive system in a flower, it's because these Gaian patterns emerged as innovations at certain times and then were used in new species in new ways. And so what happens is when a pharmaceutical is designed for a human being and released into the environment, it has very similar impacts on all living organisms that encounter it. So when we take, like they'll say, oh, they'll give us some pharmaceutical and say, take it three times a day. And the reason why we have to keep taking it is because our body, you know, you put it in there and our body goes, wow, gee, what the heck is that? You know, and then
right.
It starts excreting it. You know, it goes, let's get rid of that thing. And so you go to the bathroom and you urinate it or defecate it out. It goes into the water supply and continues to be active as a pharmaceutical throughout the ecosystem. Now, the thing is that endocrinologists such as Louis Gillette, who's at I think the University of Florida has been doing a lot of work with endocrine disruptors on male reproductive systems. He said this great thing. He said, you know, we didn't check for one part per million because we didn't think it would be active. But he said, in fact, everything from 10 parts per trillion on up,
my gosh,
are very active in the ecosystems. And he says, in fact, the lower the amount, the more active it sometimes is, which has presented extreme difficulties for toxicology assessment. Most scientists don't want to know that a tiny, tiny substance cascades upward through living organisms and produces very large effects at the macro level. So these things are subtly altering the entire function of the entire ecosystem, the way it works. Bacteria, all life forms are being shifted, and it's a much more pervasive problem than people realize, in part because this stuff goes directly into the water supply, which is mostly underground. This stuff needs extensive exposure to sunlight or heat to biodegrade it, and it's not going to get it in a water system.
Amazing. And so, I mean, it's basically just a chemistry experiment out of control that nobody has any idea where it's going.
It is, you know, and Theo Kolbern and a lot of those guys in Our Stolen Future looked at a lot of that, and I was the first one to kind of put it in a popular book, looking at it across the wide spectrum. Many people have looked at, oh, you know, PCBs or DDT or things like that. But actually looking at what pharmaceuticals do, it's an incredibly new field, and actually very little is being done on it.
It's amazing, yeah. And like you say, I mean, there's been enough released into the environment that I think you make the note that it probably, were it not the fact that bacteria and these other life forms can evolve and change and become more resistant, it would have killed everything.
Yeah, basically enough antibiotics have been released into the environment in the last 60 years to kill all life on Earth permanently. Bacteria are highly intelligent, and a lot of researchers are recognizing this now, though they're calling it genomic intelligence rather than just intelligence. intelligence.
Right, right. You've got to separate it, right.
They actually don't get that our intelligence is just a specific instance of a general phenomenon in the Gaian system.
Mm-hmm.
So these bacteria are able to analyze exactly what the pharmaceuticals will do and then alter their gene structure in order to produce a different physical form so that they're immune to it. And it's only because that they have done that that any of us are still alive on this planet.
Do you think, and maybe this is a silly question, but it seems valid to me, a species that is intelligent, a bacteria or a plant or whatever, when we commit genocide basically against a species and try to eliminate them, do you think that they respond and recognize it as sort of aggression? In other words, it seems to me that certain plants will try to recruit people to try to help their cause in a war that's being fought against them.
Well, I think it's always, extremely dangerous to declare war of any sort because it always has unintended consequences.
Yes.
You know, when you say bring them on, it kind of is a red flag to a bull whenever you do it. It doesn't work out. So we basically declared war on bacteria, which are not only co-inhabitants of the earth with us, they are our progenitors. We are merely complex forms of bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So by doing that, we actually force them into a position where they began communicating with each other through a kind of a bacterial internet at a much higher rate than they'd ever done before. And they exchange resistance information and virulence information. They can actually detach sequences of their DNA or copy them, and then other bacteria can insert it into their own. So it's like they literally absorb a program for response, and they're much more capable of it than we are. I mean, they're much, much older. So, at first we killed off a lot of the nice susceptible ones, but now all of the rest of them are pretty much like Afghan militants up in the hills with their bandoliers of bullets.
Oh, what a great analogy.
So the ecosystem responds. Now, I think human beings are supposed to be doing a lot of the things that they're doing. The question really becomes, what is our ecological purpose, the human species on this planet? And I think many of the things we're doing is to enhance that ecological purpose. Nevertheless, there is an arc to this certain thing that's happening, like all things. And as we do this more and more and more, the ecosystem has to restore balance. The Gaian ecosystem is not going to roll over just because human beings, think they have opposable thumbs.
Right, right. Amazing. Okay, look, we got time for maybe one more here. Let me give you a question and let you just expand on this a little bit, because it's one that is in my mind a lot lately, because I am a father and I'm always thinking about the children of mine and my and everybody else's, and about their future. So we talked about the native peoples having this view of the world, sort of a living world, and you commented on how frequently most of us in the quote-unquote modern world don't get a chance to view the world in that manner. So how can we teach our children to see a living world, to view the world as alive, even if they're maybe in a situation where they're not in nature, which is the case, unfortunately, for so many of our children?
I think that the most important thing is the relationship that parents themselves have with their children. One of the things I've been working with a whole lot now is the concept of disarming, of internally deciding to become extremely intimate in every situation in which I find myself. And it's a very challenging kind of dynamic, since I, like most people, have been trained to hide parts of myself or defend parts of myself I feel bad about or that I think there's something wrong with. And the thing I found in raising my own son, who's 23, it was a constant challenge for me. Do I train him to fit into the technological world, or do I train him to fit into the world?
Right, right.
And I finally decided to train him to fit in with the world. And probably the person I admire most who's written about this is John, I think it's Taylor Gatto, who's written a lot about the dumbing down of American children in the school system. He was like one of New York City's major teachers, won all of these awards.
Right, right, I know him, yeah.
Harper's had a nice article that came out a few years ago by him about this, and he talks about what normal children are like if they're not interfered with. But I found that the core to all of this is if the parents remain in a constant state of intimacy with the child and view themselves as and the child as equals, even though that they're providing certain limits to make sure the child gets mature and that they're giving them the benefits of a certain amount of knowledge, and if when the child hits puberty they become their friend rather than their parent.
Right.
And there's nothing a teenager hates worse than parental advice. But what happens is that experience of true intimacy with the parent, they begin to naturally expand to the world around them. So that they, because the act of intimacy, if you think about it, a mother's love for her child is not any different than a plant's care for its seed or a bear's care for its cubs.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of intimacy dynamic between parent and child is pervasive in the ecosystem. It's not something unique to us.
Right.
So enhancing that intimacy so the child automatically responds to the world from that place, they then begin to see those patterns in the environment and respond to them naturally.
Stephen, we haven't talked about the heart in our conversation. How does the human heart fall into this whole equation?
Well, the human heart is actually an extremely sophisticated organ of perception and cognition. Not only can you perceive with the heart, but you can think with it. And that's the crucial thing. You know, indigenous and ancient cultures, when asked where they live in their body, they would gesture to the region of the chest,
mm-hmm.
not the head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Tarahumara Indians said the largest soul in the body is in the heart. The second largest is in the head. And so that concept of reclaiming the heart as a primary organ, I mean, one of the ways to do that is to constantly pay attention to your feelings. Like when you go to a restaurant, you ask yourself, how does this place feel? Or a chair, how does it feel? Or so that you begin to train yourself to notice the response of the heart to what is presented to the senses 24 hours a day. And as that happens, there's this communicative process that begins to occur between the earth, between the systems outside of the human being and the human being, and that there's kind of an electric field or electromagnetic field that surrounds everything, and within that is encoded huge amounts of information about the thing itself. And our heart field changes depending upon how we feel, our level of health, our intention, everything. And it's this field that can be measured up to 10 feet from the body, but it extends much further out. And when two living forms have this touch of a heart field and there's this kind of a synchronization that can occur, there's an exchange that happens, usually accompanied by this very deep breath. And the Greeks had a word for it. It was called a sthesis, the moment when there was an exchange of soul essence between two things.
Mm. It's beautiful.
And that process, I mean, it's something I go into detail in the book, but and we can only touch a little bit on now, but there's this combining of spirit that's possible between a human being and a plant, for instance. And in that moment of synchronicity is when there's this tremendous exchange of information, often experienced as a vision or a waking dream. And one of the neat things about strongly psychoactive plants is they serve to activate that process at an extremely high level. That's what they do.
Mm. Do you ever find this coming through in the dream time? You spoke about 24 hours a day in the dreamscape. Do you ever find information from the plants?
Oh, do you mean when I'm sleeping?
Yeah, when you're asleep.
Sometimes I do that, but I used to have, my dreams were so active, I trained myself to forget them because I wanted to have periods of unconscious.
Oh, that's funny. Most people are trying so hard to remember.
No, there's certain moments when ignorance truly is bliss.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what, the last hour wasn't one of them. This has been wonderful, Stephen. Thank you so much for your time. As always, we'll get this thing up and on the air for people and let them enjoy it. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it, but thank you so much for your words, as always.
You're welcome, Mike. It's great to be on.
All right, everybody. Stephen Herod Buhner. We'll get information about the website and all that to you in just a few moments, okay? All right, everybody. It is Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit. It's KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And about 4 minutes after one now on the 9th of January, 2007. And should have done my top of the hour station ID a couple of minutes ago, but anyway, mea culpa to the FCC, not anybody else. All right, let's see. Let's play a song here. Play one more from Yachai. New stuff from the Insect Sessions. This is called Perfect Mantis. Then we'll come back. There are a couple questions that came up in the chat room that I'll address just because the people have hung out. And then we can talk about some news. I wouldn't mind talking a little bit about global climate change. I got a couple emails, and it's sort of related to what we've been talking about tonight with Stephen. Sort of some funny stories have come to mind as well. So anyway, let's just listen to another piece of music here from Yachai. It's called Perfect Mantis. And then we'll come back and do that other stuff, okay? Thanks for listening. Stick around. Going to be fun. We got another hour left, and back in just a few, okay? It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.
Thank you.
All right. Perfect Mantis. New stuff from Yachai Music. Yachai, Jeff and William, great stuff. Thanks for sharing it with us. And that's from the Insect Sessions. You can find information about these guys and their music on the web at Yachai Music, Y-A-C-H-A-Y, music.com. And also, this particular project has its own site, theinsectsessions.com. All right? All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. And great to be with you here, back at you now, after hopefully what you thought was a worthwhile interview with Stephen Herod Buhner. I always love talking to Stephen. I think he's an amazing guy. And a couple of things before we move along. We'll keep talking about plants for a little while here because there's some questions that came up that I'll answer or at least do my best to address that came from the chat. And we can talk about some news in a little while here. And I don't know what else, but this one's sort of important. And someone asks, hi, Mike. Please talk about some native ayahuasca analog plants during question time. And for probably a lot of people out there that are listening, this is sort of old news or preaching to the converted sort of business. But anyway, I'll go through it just in case, for historical purposes, you know, for people who hear in the future that don't know what this stuff is, and then, you know, for people who are listening who aren't familiar. So anyway, ayahuasca is it's a brew. It's a combinatory beverage, essentially, that is made by shamans. That means men and women, primarily in Mexico, Central and South America. And it is a real interesting concoction. It primarily consists of two ingredients, two plants, one from which the name comes from. Ayahuasca is the name of a vine that grows down there in the southern hemisphere. And so it's actually the name of the vine. They actually call it that. The you know, if you're a botanist, they call it Banisteriopsis caapi. And then there is another plant that they combine with the Banisteriopsis to make this stuff, and that one's called Socotria viridis. And the Maya, the Quechua Maya, call it Chacruna. And anyway, it's a really interesting thing because you have to mix it together and boil it for an extended period of time, and then drive it down and, you know, separate out the solid materials. And, I mean, it's quite an alchemical production, actually. And this is one of the amazing things about ayahuasca and you know, one of the mysteries, you know, why Western scientists were interested in it and have since given it up and pretty much banished it because, you know, they banish anything that they can't understand or describe. And the psychedelic experience is certainly, you know, right up there with the best of them when it comes to things that science has no idea how to describe. Anyway, the active ingredient in Socotria viridis is DMT, dimethyltryptamine. And the problem with dimethyltryptamine is if you eat it, you won't get off because there are enzymes in your stomach that will destroy the DMT before it gets to the place it needs to get, primarily through what they call the blood-brain barrier. And the trick that the shamans figured out thousands of years ago, certainly, was to combine Socotria viridis with Banisteriopsis caapi with the ayahuasca vine, because the ayahuasca vine contains a bunch of different alkaloids, primarily what they call harmala alkaloids, and these harmala alkaloids are beta carbolines. They're MAO inhibitors, and the MAO inhibitors in ayahuasca temporarily disable the enzymes in your stomach that normally destroy DMT before it breaks that blood-brain barrier and allow it to do so. And so what you get is a DMT trip that's orally active, what they call orally active, which, you know, is a miracle. You know, the synthetic DMT users that arose in the 60s had to smoke it. You know, you couldn't eat it. And that's what drove, you know, some people who were interested in this stuff to the Amazon, because there were, you know, there was some literature that somehow made it, you know, into their world. And the literature said that, you know, go to South America and you'll find this stuff, and you'll find, you know, a DMT cocktail that actually can be taken orally, and the experience dramatically extended from the time that you experience if you actually smoke DMT. So, anyway, ayahuasca is this combinatory beverage, and it's unbelievable that it was ever even invented, because, like I say, it's not something that's simple. There are some, you know, 400,000 different plant species in the, you know, the area of the world where these things grow, and somehow these people were able to figure out not only which two to combine, but also how to combine them. Like I said, it's an elaborate preparatory deal. And if you ask the shamans, they'll tell you exactly what Stephen would tell you, is that plants can give you information. They say that the plants taught them, told them exactly what to do, how to do it, and that's what's been scoffed at, basically, by Western science for, you know, ever since they've been investigating this stuff. But, I mean, sort of the proof is in the pudding. You have to just, you have to see what the result is, you know. That's the bottom line, is that it actually works, and nobody can describe, you know, they may deny what the shamans say, and, you know, but they don't have any better answer, I'll tell you that much. So, anyway, ayahuasca, prepared by these ayahuasqueros, or ayahuasqueras, is this magical potion that, when imbibed in the right circumstances, you know, and with the right head on, all of this stuff, you know, you have to have your act together. It's not for the faint of heart, and you have to be prepared for what you're getting into, which is why you have to be educated, and why we need to be talking about this stuff instead of, you know, instead of just parroting one-liners like "just say no" and this sort of thing. I mean, you know, what we should be saying no to are the pharmaceuticals that are being peddled, you know, and pushed down our throats from every perceivable angle. Right. So anyway, there are good drugs and there are bad drugs, and some of that depends on how you use them. And in this case, we're talking about something that, you know, should not be messed with. Nothing should be messed with. You know, you don't fiddle with things. What you do is you learn about them. You make a reasonable, rational decision about, you know, if you think that it would be a benefit or otherwise to yourself and your community, your family, whatever. And then you act accordingly. All right? Well, ayahuasca, you know, ayahuasca is now something that's actually been legitimized here, even in the fascist West, United States, post-millennial crash. You know, the Supreme Court last year approved the use of ayahuasca by the Brazilian church that makes its home here in the United States. So, you know, if you want to do it legally, join the church. Regardless, this stuff is in the world and loose on the planet, and it has its own agenda. The plants have their own agenda. And ayahuasca is this amazing plant that well, it's an amazing plant and an amazing plant combination in the beverage, but it does amplify what Stephen was talking about. You know, he said that he believed that all plants are psychotropic. It's just that some of them are more insistent than others. Well, this is one of the ones that's pretty insistent and can teach you a thing or two, for sure. So, back to the question. The question was, are there any North American analogs? And, yeah, there's been quite a bit of work done on that, I think, over the years. And by analogs, it basically just mean, you know, has anyone been able to, you know, come up with something with local plants or whatever where they could sort of achieve the same effect? So the answer is yes and no. The deal is that, you know, ayahuasca analogs are you can prepare them using plants that are not the traditional ones, you know, not the Banisteriopsis capi and not the Psychotria. But what you have to do is you have to find, see, DMT is in all kinds of things. It's almost it's basically in every plant that have been studied now that people have actually looked at it a little bit. Dennis says that it's basically everywhere in every plant that he's ever come across. But, you know, it has different levels, you know, different, you know, higher or lower concentrations of that chemical, which, by the way, you know, for people who are tuning in and saying, what the hell are these guys talking about? Dimethyltryptamine is the particular compound we're talking about right now, and it exists in your brain naturally, endogenously, in your human chemistry. It's not a drug. It's a neurotransmitter. That's what these things are, all right? They are neurotransmitters, and they are doorways into the unimaginable, and they should not be ignored, and they're not going to be ignored any longer. So anyway, an analog is, you know, something that tries to copy the same thing. So what we do is we find another plant in the local environment that has DMT, or at least you know, a level of DMT that can be drawn out of it. And that's no big deal, really, because it's all over the place. But there are some things like, there's one plant that's called Mimosa hostilis. You use that in place of the chacruna. Australia's got some indigenous plants that that are DMT rich. In the Midwest here in the United States, there's this one that Terrence used to talk about called Illinois bundleweed, Desmanthus illinoisensis. And but the key is the MAO inhibitor. And that Syrian rue, the seeds, I think it's called Pagamon harmala. Pagamon harmala. But it's the seeds from the Syrian rue plant. And you can get that stuff at any, like, international market that sells, like, Middle Eastern foods and that sort of thing. But, you know, and then you have to combine the stuff and do the same thing, you know. It basically, like I said earlier, perform an alchemical, you know, thing. And, you know, don't try this at home. You know, because if you get it right, you know, it will work. And you have to be careful, because like all good doctors, you have to take the medicine certainly before you ever give it to anybody else, you know. And it's too bad more doctors, you know, in our culture don't sort of abide by those same guidelines. But anyway, in this case, you're messing around with serious stuff, and there are different, obviously, mixtures and recipes in order to achieve the end result. But, you know, just beware, because you are messing with stuff that, you know, it's not going to kill you. But you might wish you were dead. You know, learn is the key. Go to the library, learn. Go to the internet, learn. If you're interested in that sort of thing, if you're interested in recipes and that sort of thing, you got to really, really, really know your stuff before you start messing with this stuff, all right? All right, anyway, that's ayahuasca. And, yeah, analogs for sure. But, you know, you're on your own when it comes to coming up with them. All right, what else do we have to talk about here? Well, there's just sort of a general question from a few people about how I got interested in plants and that stuff to begin with. And it's simple. It's Terrence. It's Terrence McKenna. By pure serendipity, I had very little interest in this stuff 15 years ago. And since then, it has become a greater and greater and more important piece of my life. And, you know, I don't claim to know it all or anything like that. And I'm, you know, I'm like anybody else, just going along the road trying to learn and trying to parse my experiences with what I've been taught and what I'm told about the world and that sort of thing. And, you know, eventually I just got to the point where I said, well, I have to break. I have to make a break with the culture and the norms that they are enforcing primarily, you know. Because for me, the first data, the first and most important data that anybody can take and put in the machinery to grind out their worldview has to be the primary data of experience. What happened to you? What did you feel like when you drank ayahuasca? What do you feel like when you have sex? What do you feel like when you see brutality and shamelessness and destruction? You know? What do you feel? That's the primary data. And from there you move outward. You know? I'm not into taking decrees that are laid on from above by some monkey hierarchy. And, you know, eventually I did go outside. You know? I went outside. I started eating stuff that lives outside with their permission. And the rest is, you know, an ongoing story. And it's a beautiful story, you know. I love it. The more I familiarize myself and the more I deepen my relationship with the natural world, you know, and it's not an abstract thing like that. I said, you know, as I deepen my relationship with specific species that live, that share the planet with us, you know, my life becomes more rich and more full and more enlightened, you know. They teach. They teach. It's amazing, you know. And so this idea of relationship, which I've talked about before, and I'm not the first, for God's sake, but I'm just trying to continue the message, you know, of some of the people that have been such a great influence on me. Because, you know, you want to see this stuff continue because it's very, very strong. You know, it's a very strong compulsion and drive to share. But the situation that we're in with regard to the environment on the planet can't be resolved from, you know, Al Gore-esque flashy DVDs and Kyoto treaties and this sort of thing. It doesn't work like that. Nobody knows what's going on, first of all. All they can do is observe that things are changing and it appears to be, you know, a tremendous amount of flux, but nobody really knows what's going on. They say they do, owns of CO2 and this and that and caused by this. Nobody knows what the F is going on. You know? That's just one of many variables anyway. They don't even take into consideration the sun, the position of the solar system. They should be reading things like, what the heck's the guy's name? The guy that wrote Planetesimal state of earth and life? Oh man, I can't remember it. I'm gonna go find it. It's because it's gonna drive me crazy because I have to make sure that I say it on the air. Alexei, yeah, Dr. Dmitriev, Russian scientist, you know, who wrote this amazing paper in 1997 called The Planetophysical State of Earth and Life. And he makes the brilliant observation of what's happening on a macro level. You know, the entire solar system is in a state of flux. It's got nothing to do with us monkeys, you know. We may be exacerbating the situation down here, certainly. I mean, we're doing a lot of things that aren't smart. I recognize that, you know. Duh. There's a big difference between that and saying we know what's going on and then trying to prescribe solutions for it. The solutions could be just as dangerous as the symptoms right now because you don't know what's going on. There's all kinds of things that are happening on the planet, off the planet, on the sun, intergalactically. So global warming is not a hoax. You have some people that say global warming is a hoax. It's not a hoax. That's maybe a oversimplification. It's global dynamic change. But the hoax is the official version, you know, the Kyoto Treaty storyline, the Al Gore Inconvenient Truth storyline, the one that gets peddled, you know, in the pop culture and in the mainstream media, that we are primarily responsible for the current spikes, and that's not the thing, even if we are, you know. There are so many things that are involved that to try to prescribe some sort of solution. The solution that they offer is mainly increased taxes and increased fuel costs, that sort of thing. Then you look at guys like Al Gore. It doesn't take long. You know, all you need is a search engine to find out where his bread is buttered, right? Occidental Oil, responsible for the destruction and desecration of native peoples and native lands to this day, right now, in South America. You know, they're also in the mining business. It's a long, long story with the Gore family, right? So this is just hucksterish. You know, the same old robber baron huckster shtick that's been done for 100 years. And because people have short memory, and because the media is complicit and, in fact, you know, a part of the whole project, you know, it can be allowed to continue. But, you know, nothing lasts forever. I always say that. Stephen made the great point about environmentalists and, you know, the idea of being so concerned about chemicals and this sort of thing being dumped out there in the fields and this and that, but then, you know, they themselves will eat pharmaceutical products and then excrete them, and then the same thing happens. All that stuff goes out into the environment. The real story is that this thing is completely out of control. Nobody knows what's happening, and if you think you do, or if you got someone who says they know, run for the door. All right, the deal now is hang on, Hannah. Because nobody knows what's coming. So your best bet is to get straight with the earth, get straight with the plants, recognize that relationships are not limited to human beings. You can have relationships with other creatures, other species on this planet, and not just la-di-da, you know, new age relationships. You can have real, meaningful, communicative relationship with other species on the planet. And certainly the plant kingdom is one of them. And they're very interested in communicating with you. But like any relationship, sort of obey the laws of, you know, polite behavior. You've got to be looking for a friend, be willing to introduce yourself, and be willing to go through what you go through with any other relationship, you know, the establishment of trust and everything that happens after that. All right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And we'll hear another song here from our friends Yachai. This is from the Insect Sessions. It's called Growl. And might read something over it in a second. But anyway, in the meantime, this is Growl. And it's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. It is possible to dissect a human being, render it down into its constituent parts, feed them into a machine which measures such things and determine from that its ability to paint or create great music? No? And why do you think that once you have done this with my body, you know anything about me? Growl, and that's off of the Insect Sessions. Now, I'm not sure exactly how Jeff and William are going to distribute this music. I got a couple of different CDs that contained two or three songs each, and I'm not sure if that's how they're going to do it, but I think that one was from the CD that was entitled Hibiscus. At any rate, great stuff, and thanks for sharing it with us, you guys. That's Yachai, and you can find information about them on the web at yachaymusic.com. You can also link there from my site at mikehagan.com. Click over to the music archives. You'll find much of the music that we've listened to over the last year or so here, and we're trying to expand and improve that archive. And Stephen Herod Buhner, thank you so much, Stephen, for doing the program. And you can find information about Stephen on the web at www.gaianstudies.org. And let's see, I'm going to take a peek in the chat room real fast here. And hemp, people are talking about hemp. Mike, has the plant marijuana helped you become a plant person? Well, I mean, learning about hemp for sure, is a big deal. From an intelligence standpoint, and this is something that I address to my local listeners and the local, politicos and the local environmentalist and sustainable living community people and everybody that's interested in a reasonable future, you know, and I mean this locally. We've got all kinds of talk here in Columbia about sustainable future and how we can get people together to do this and do that and, you know, what we can do, the decriminalization, the legalization of hemp farming of even come up in the conversation? If it has, I haven't heard it. This is ridiculous. We live in Missouri, you know? Talk about a cash crop. You know, but there are political problems that are ridiculous. They're, you know, political and business related, you know, corporate agendas and money-making machine problems that come into this whole game. Because it's absolutely outrageous, the situation with hemp, you know. This is the only known plant. First of all, it's probably the oldest cultivated plant in human history. 5,000 years we have record of it. But it's the only known plant that can be grown from the equator all the way up and down. You can grow it on the mountains, near the oceans, on the plains, on arid land. It's a very healthy plant for the ground out of many, many, many known species. It has a root system that is very beneficial to the earth itself, to the ground in which it lives. The roots are very deeply penetrating, and they beat the soil up real good and make it arable. There's all kinds of information that's available from federal and state, Department of Agriculture people, Popular Mechanics, Popular Science, Pulp and Paper, Magazine, Scientific American, you name it, over the last 200 years, that is public information. And it's information that has been held back from the public. There's been a tremendously derisive PR campaign for at least 70 years. And it is absolutely ridiculous what's happening here, right? 125 years ago, 80% of our economy was based on the use of cannabis / hemp for paper, for fiber, for fuel. And a whole bunch of the drug economy was based on the same stuff, medicines. Cannabis was a part of everyday life. Virtually on every farm, virtually every plot of land, cities and towns across the U.S. 100 years ago, cannabis was growing there. It was the number one annually renewable natural resource for 80% of all paper, fiber, textiles, fuel for about 6,000 years, stopping about 100 years ago. Most of the rope, twine, cord, ship sails, canvas, cloth was made out of this stuff. It was replaced by like DuPont's petrochemical stuff. The nylon synthesis began in 1937. And if you look at what happened correspondingly in the legal sphere, you know, things start to become pretty clear. You know, hemp seed oil is also something that's really good and really beneficial. It used to be used for lighting oil all around the world. Lots of paints and varnishes used it. It's non-toxic. Biodiesel is a big deal these days, right? You can make biodiesel out of it, high-grade biodiesel. The U.S. Army and the Navy standards, if you look at their purchasing specifications, they will list hemp oil as the number one preferred lubricant for their machinery. So there are all kinds of reasons, right? As a matter of fact, there was even a guy in the DEA, a judge. His name was Francis Young. And in 1988, he actually said, marijuana in its natural form, and it should be called cannabis. Marijuana is a bastardization for political purposes of what the plant is really called. Anyway, marijuana in its natural form is one of the safest therapeutically active substances known to man, and asked the Drug Enforcement Administration to reschedule it. The DEA refused, keeping it as a Schedule I drug, which they say has no known medical use. Now, there have been thousands of studies that have been done all over the world. England, Spain, Holland, even in the U.S., you know, that document the medical use of cannabis. Not one person has ever died from a cannabis overdose. Here's an article right here from newscientist.com. October 13th, 2005. Marijuana might cause new cell growth in brain. A synthetic chemical similar to the active ingredient in marijuana makes new cells grow in rat brains. What is more, in rats, the cell growth appears to be linked with reducing anxiety and depression. The results suggest that marijuana, or its derivatives, could actually be good for the brain. Well, there you have it. So, anyway, I could go on and on about this. And it is a wonderful plant. And it can do a lot of things to help the situation that we're in. You know, the problem is, it essentially eliminates the paper pulp industry, or changes it dramatically. Wow, we no longer have to chop down trees. Darn it all, right? The cotton industry would be in deep trouble. Do you know how much pesticide is used on cotton? Like a boatload of it. I mean, like a huge percentage of all pesticides that are used on cotton. You don't even need pesticides, for the most part, on hemp. It's stronger than cotton, softer. Anyway, lots of good reasons to look at the law with regard to the cultivation of hemp. And I'd encourage that locally and regionally here in Missouri. You know, there's good reason for it, and people should be talking about it. I hope maybe they'll hear this rant and raving that I do sometimes. I don't know. Sometimes you wonder. Okay, what else is there to talk about? Let's see. You know, I was... Oh, my God, I'm thinking about this. This time when I drove to Las Vegas with my friend Johnny, who's a brilliant cab driver in Denver. And I say that with all seriousness. Anyway, we used to drive to Las Vegas when I was living in Denver. And we talked about all this stuff, you know, global warming and the environment and sustainable living and hemp and marijuana and why everything was upside down and all this stuff. And anyway, we drove to Vegas one time in Johnny's little car. He has a Geo Metro. And it doesn't even have air conditioning. It's three cylinders. It's like a little sewing machine engine with four wheels attached to it. And anyway, we were just cruising down the highway in Johnny's little Geo. And from Denver, you go through Colorado, obviously, then into Utah. And from Utah into Nevada. Well, not long after you get into Nevada, on the way to Vegas, I think it's Highway 15, I'm not sure exactly, but anyway, you actually go through this place that they actually call. The real name of it is called the Valley of Fire. All right? They call it the Valley of Fire. And when Johnny and I were driving through this place in a little Geo, sweating, I mean, the Geo was like a convection oven. You couldn't even open the windows. It was cooler if you kept the windows closed, because when you open the windows, it became like a convection oven. And we were driving through the Valley of Fire in this little car with no air conditioning and talking about energy, right? Well, I mean, I swear to God, at the same time, we look at each other and just start cracking up, because we both realized at the exact same moment something just hysterical. And Johnny said, "Can you believe that this whole place isn't covered with solar panels?" You know? And I was like, "I know," and we laughed so hard about it, but I mean, this is the truth of the matter. It's like we've got the sun, this burning ball of energy that's just dumping, you know, more energy than we could ever use in our lifetimes on us every moment of every day, and we continue to burn dead animals and plants, which of course brings us back full circle to what the whole program has been about tonight. It's about plants. You know, oil, you know, which is the number one crack addiction of the 21st century, and which is about to be, you know, recovered from, hopefully. It's plants. And that's what history is. It is a series of relationships made and broken with plants. And we have been very naive in the in recent history, let's just put it that way, with regard to these creatures that share this planet with us, because they do have intelligence, and they do have agenda, and they are looking for friends and allies, just like we are. And you know, people would be wise to consider them when they consider their place in the world and the way they look at it. All right, it's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We'll be back next week with Kent Stedman. Yeah. I hate to say it, but I'm glad that the interview with Kevin Warwick got delayed, postponed, because it's time to talk to Kent. I can't wait to have him on the air, and we'll do it next week. 7 days, actually 6 days and 21 hours from now. Kent Stedman from cyberspaceorbit.com. All right. In the meanwhile, have a great week, and we'll get back with you next time. Check us out on the web, www.mikehagan.com. And thanks to KOPN, as always, on the web, kopn.org. And thanks to everybody who listens to the program and who participates every week. I love you guys all. We'll be back. And I can't wait to do it. Take care of yourselves. This is called The World is Made of Language. Thanks one more time to Stephen Herod Buhner and Yachai. Thank you.